Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I am Michael Footer.
And I'm Amanda Farrow.
On each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats, bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros.
And we have an industry bro again joining us today. Who are we talking to today?
Later in the show, we will be talking to my former colleague. Uh-huh. We will be talking to a man who once hawked premium computer glasses.
Oh man, he really did.
He did. And the man who is the CEO of New Blood Interactive, one Mr. David Oshry.
This is going to be quite the conversation.
It is going to be quite the conversation. I'm really looking forward to it. Dave's work with New Blood has been fantastic, but more importantly, the way he represents the company and his very transparent views about what a developer or publisher's role, especially in this economy, in this environment that we're in right now.
In these very strange times.
In these very, very strange times. I'm really excited to talk to Dave. But before we do that, there's some news to talk about.
We're moving into our new format, like full steam ahead.
We are, absolutely.
Full steam ahead.
That's a good segue, Amanda.
I'm really good at segues. That one wasn't even on purpose. All right, so let's walk through Steam's new update policy, because this is very, very different for them.
Yes, it is. This kind of piggybacks on our conversation last week about Sony letting people know, first in Europe, then in the United States, that it was going to be throttling downloads in order to be mindful of the fact that there are a lot of people who are working in unusual settings out of their houses. And we'll talk about how we talk about that a little bit later. But Sony is throttling downloads. My understanding is Microsoft is kind of doing the same thing. Sony said that they're working with ISPs. Steam now has taken some, for them, as you mentioned, some extraordinary measures.
Yes. So one of those extraordinary measures that they are going to be taking is that they are only going to be updating games that have been played over the last 3 days. So for some of us that have been only playing Animal Crossing, for example.
Who could that be?
I mean,
I'm raising my hand.
Yeah, he's definitely raising his hand. I have not only been playing Animal Crossing, I've been playing Civ.
Yeah. I've also been playing Murder by Numbers, but that's also on my Switch.
So you're a Switch man. That's what you're saying.
I'm a Switch hitter.
Things are getting weird. They're getting weird. Abort. So anyway, infrequently played games are going to be manually updated.
So for those of us who have large Steam libraries and large hard drives on which to house them, you might be used to all of your games updating as soon as those games receive an update. So if you haven't played something in a week, if you haven't played something in a month, those games are still getting updates.
Or in our case, maybe a year.
In our case, maybe a year. Yeah, I mean, I've got games. I constantly am freeing up hard drive space. I'm tidying up, and then I'm downloading a bunch of stuff. But the chance, like, on Steam, I think at the game that I played, there's one game that I played in the last 3 days, and I think it was Doom 2016.
Yes.
So that game, should it receive an update, which why would it right now, would be updated. But anything else, yes, you'll have to manually update. Now, if you play it, then the update will be queued. If you know there's an update, you're going to want to make sure that update hits.
Yeah, exactly, that you manually queue it for an update before you go ahead and, you know, jump into whatever game that you're going to be playing. Mm-hmm. So why is this such an unusual decision for Steam?
So Steam, you know, one of its big features, and if you go all the way back to, you know, 20 years or so ago when yeah.
Oh, yeah. I need a nap. Oh, that was a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, that hurt.
So when Steam came on the scene, the big thing about Steam was that it kept all of your games in one place. Mm-hmm. It updated those games automatically. That was a huge innovation when Steam came on.
It was.
So that was the thing that Steam was first known for, was, hey, we're just going to manage all your updates for you. Game comes out on our storefront. It's in your library. We got you.
Yeah, we're gonna make sure that we're going to take care of you so that you're not having to download patches. Mm-hmm. We'll just do it for you.
Yeah, and manually patching was a thing that those of us who were PC gamers... pre-Steam.
Oh, and yeah. They hurt, yeah. Sometimes. Like, having to sit back because your patch didn't actually work properly and you had to, like, go in and
mm-hmm.
edit some registry files or mess around with the INI. Like, oh.
Oh, and there were times where it'd be like, oh, I didn't read that. I shouldn't update this patch if I have this video card.
And right, exactly. And there were so many caveats back in the day where mm-hmm. it's like, yes, I definitely want to be up to date on my patches to make sure that this game works properly. And
yeah.
I borked the whole install And also my registry is now extremely messed up.
Yep.
Whoops.
Yeah, that was my life in college for sure. So
college for me.
I know. Valve has also made some recommendations to its users for ways that they can help. And there are three core recommendations. One is for games you're not playing regularly, but you do keep on your hard drive, or you do play, you know, infrequently, because those updates, this is the thing, those updates are, it's not that they're not going to be queued or show up in your library under the download section. They're going to be scheduled for off hours. And this has happened to me multiple times. Like, I don't know if it's my system or my account. There are times where I have to be like, yeah, like, do this update now instead of waiting until off peak. They're going to be moving all of those updates into off peak.
Yeah. So like 2-3 o'clock in the morning mm-hmm. is where you're going to see a lot of these games being updated.
Yeah. But they have suggested that for some games that you want to keep on your hard drive that you might not play regularly, even those games that might see an update, but during off peak hours, you can opt out of auto updates for a game. And they said that that is one way that you can manage this process. They've also suggested this is something that none of us use on a regular basis, probably, unless you're in an environment where your general house bandwidth is or apartment bandwidth is not great, or you have bandwidth caps to worry about.
Oh man, bandwidth caps right now.
Yeah. You can, and a lot of companies
have softened that.
In fact, we got a text message from Verizon telling us they were giving us 15 gigabytes of mobile broadband hotspot data, which was nice. You can self-throttle. So most people, I assume, have their Steam download speed set at max.
Yeah.
You know, pull as much as you possibly can and damn everybody else in the house. But you can self-throttle in Steam. You can tell it how much bandwidth to actually use. So Steam is doing its part to ensure that it is handling things on its own end.
Like, yes.
For what it can handle. And it's also making recommendations to its users about how they can participate. So now we've seen Microsoft, we've seen Sony, we've seen Steam.
Yes.
Involved in this whole thing we're managing.
This ecosystem of kerfuffle.
Yeah. I like the way Sony put it. It was something about being mindful of the community.
Yeah, exactly. The really interesting thing about this is that we're in this working situation, and it's not just about work either, Mike. It's mm-hmm. about learning, because, you know, there are children that are home. I don't know if college kids are working from home.
A lot of kids are in remote, you know, a lot of college kids are in remote learning as well. So we've got high school kids, we've got elementary school kids, we've got college kids who are home and not on those infrastructures. On top of that, we've got work issues.
Exactly.
Right? And we talked with Scott Hartzman about this last week. Now, interestingly, as we've been talking about it on the show, we've called it WFH or work from home.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking about this and you know, mentioning the things that we're going to be talking about on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Pete Hines from Bethesda reached out to me. And this all came from a conversation. He's on the board of Take This, which is one of our favorite charities.
Yep.
It's a charity that exists to destigmatize mental health in the gaming community, or mental health issues in the gaming community.
That's right. Yeah.
And promote good mental health, and has a number of services, including the AFK room, ID of shows. Remember conventions?
Gosh, remember conventions?
I do. I feel like we were at one months ago, but it was at the beginning of the month when we were at...
Oh, no! It was like 4 weeks ago. That's it. It's only
been 4 weeks.
It feels like 4 years.
It does. And Pete's on the board of Take This, and mentioned this on a board call or board meeting, at a board meeting, a remote board meeting,
mm-hmm.
that work from home carries its own stigma, its own connotation, whether that's positive or negative.
It really does depend on the company that you end up mm-hmm. working for, because there are some companies that very much so embrace work from home as a part of, you know, the way that they do business. And then there are other companies, especially larger corporations, doesn't matter if they're multinational or not, there are many corporations out there that just do not want work from home to be a part of their workplace culture for one reason or another. It could be security, it could be culture issues, it could be the need to micromanage one's employees. Mm-hmm. The last of which is, in my humble slash not so humble opinion, super invalid.
Yeah. So what Pete suggested is that we move away from using work from home or WFH as the term in a situation like this, and he's proposed WUQ. And I'm like, what does that mean?
What's WUQ?
Working under quarantine.
Yes.
Or working from home under quarantine.
Right. And why is this such an important distinction?
It communicates that we are in an abnormal situation, but also that it is a pervasive situation. This isn't Absolutely. A case-by-case, individual-by-individual situation where somebody is working from it or working from home for an extended period of time.
Right.
Or even a difference in corporate culture between, you know, centralized workplace or a work.
Sure.
Working under quarantine, WUQ, really paints the picture that we're in this together. This is everybody dealing with this situation together. It moves us away from something that has a separate connotation, it has a separate meaning, and I really like that. And that is how I'll be referring to it in the future.
Yeah, I really like that too, because technically you and I have been work from home for the last decade, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And this situation is so incredibly different that yeah. there is very little overlap other than we get up in the morning, we get dressed, we have breakfast, and instead of diving into a work day or diving into what would normally be a work day routine of some kind, mm-hmm. we're homeschooling.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Crisis schooling.
Crisis schooling.
I have been reading about that. This is just like this isn't work from home. Mm-hmm. This isn't homeschooling.
Right.
This is crisis schooling, because homeschooling is something that many parents opt into after years of research. And this is a choice that they make actively because that's what they want for their kids. Whereas with us,
this is a choice that public health has thrust upon us. And
necessarily. And
there's no grudge.
No,
we're not begrudging that.
No, right? Absolutely not. It just reaffirms the fact that teachers are so incredibly desperately underpaid,
mm-hmm.
and we should pay them so much more money.
Yes.
So much more.
Teachers,
nurses, support yes. staff of all mm-hmm. kinds working in these amazing industries. Like, we should just be paying them lots
frankly,
of money.
And quite frankly, the people who stock the shelves in the supermarket.
Yes.
We're finding out who the real heroes are.
The real heroes of society, as it turns out.
The people who are still making our food.
Yep.
Because you can still do takeout or curbside pickup at most restaurants. Some have temporarily closed. A lot have permanently closed.
Yeah, that one's really sad.
And we'll talk about the ripple effect.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to...
later in the show.
We will, for sure. So the working under quarantine is a more inclusive and holistic way of looking at the professional landscape for the vast majority of people that are working in jobs that are not service
yep.
jobs. And absolutely. Just like we said, service-based jobs are super important, and the folks that are doing these jobs are absolutely amazing, especially those folks that are stocking our grocery shelves and that are working at places like Amazon or Instacart or things like that. So, you know, big round of applause for those folks, because they absolutely. Don't get enough recognition.
Absolutely. And as we talked about with Scott Hartzman,
mm-hmm.
we are going to see, not just for live service, which was the focus of that conversation,
right.
but we are going to see development delays. And there's a technological component to that. You're talking about pulling down huge files. You're talking about the general lack of productivity or lower productivity, which is not, again, this is important to talk about. This is work from home versus work under quarantine. Work from home, I am exceptionally productive.
And so am I.
So
because you and I have developed
mm-hmm.
those kinds of skills over a number of years. We're both self-motivated. You know, we have processes and methods that keep us focused throughout the day with regular breaks, blah, blah, blah. Those things don't apply right now.
Right. We have confounding factors, including we have small children that do need to be supervised during their school day because they are in school.
Yes,
and that is, and that goes from 9 o'clock in the morning when they have check-in until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So that is 5 hours of our normal 8-hour workday that is gobbled up by needing to supervise, which again, we're not begrudging that, but it is a reality of the situation.
Absolutely.
But so what we are starting to see is little delays and slightly larger delays starting to emerge. Now, Bethesda announced that its Wastelanders update, which is a huge update for Fallout 76, which adds NPCs and a lot of new stuff to the game, that was delayed a week. And that was due to working under quarantine.
Yeah.
And Bethesda was really upfront with that. Today, we've had two delays announced.
Yes.
So I guess this will be yesterday because this show is going to air tomorrow on Wednesday.
Yes.
So it's Tuesday right now when we're recording this. And the first one of those was Wasteland 3, which is under development at In Exile in partnership with Deep Silver, because it was a Kickstarter game, yes. And Deep
yes.
Silver has been doing a lot of partnerships with Kickstarters
and they,
Microsoft.
I believe that they're doing the distribution. I think that that's what the important thing is. Mm-hmm. Is that's what Deep Silver really does is distribution. Yeah, exactly.
And this is also kind of a part of a transitional period because InXile was purchased by Microsoft.
It's the same kind of thing that we saw with the Outer Worlds and Obsidian.
Absolutely.
Because that was another one of Microsoft's big purchases from last fall.
Mm-hmm. So what we saw today was a delay on Wasteland 3. And again, Brian Fargo and his studio signed off, you know, he signed the letter that went out on Twitter. And I'll just read the first paragraph here. As with most companies, we've moved to a work-from-home environment some weeks ago. And that's, of course, introduced new challenges that many of us throughout the world have been learning to manage. We've been excited to see the Wasteland 3 beta so well received, but the reality is that with these new logistical challenges, our release is going to be impacted. So I'm glad to see that studios are being upfront. And the delay here, May 19th was the original release date. It's going to the end of August.
That's still not bad. That's not an enormous delay, unlike what we're seeing with Hollywood. Like, Hollywood is delaying movies by full years at this point.
We saw Sony, I can't remember if that was yesterday, every day blends together.
It's just one big long day for the last 3 weeks.
It is. And so their summer slate, or their slate for this year, is being bumped at least a year. So Wasteland 3 was another one. There was another announcement today. Did you see this?
I don't know if I did. Which one is this one?
Minecraft Dungeons got delayed.
I did see that. Yeah, Minecraft Dungeons is going to be a really, really interesting game. But I know that the development process for any kind of ARPG has got to be bonkers.
Yeah. So it was supposed to come out next month, or yes, when you listen to it this month. So that was supposed to be April. Now it's going to be May.
Yeah.
So we're seeing, again, we're going to see these delays.
It's a slight shift. It's definitely the working under quarantine thing is we're going to see that ripple effect really start to move out. Another thing that, you know, we definitely need to talk about if we're talking about delays is shipping delays.
Absolutely. And we saw
it a little bit with Animal Crossing, right? Like, mm-hmm, the Animal Crossing physical copies were delayed by only a handful of days. Handful of days in some cases, less than that for others. Didn't really have a ton of impact because it was like, okay, well, if I really, really want to play it, then I'll cancel my pre-order and I'll just pick up the digital copy and that'll be fine. But but we're starting to see something a little bit more significant. So what are we seeing with Final Fantasy VII Remake? Because we have been talking about how Square Enix is handling this. And sure, we talked about it, I think, during our first week of shows.
I think so, and it's been an evolving story. First, there was the Amazon notice that went out that the release date had become unknown.
Yeah.
Which frightened people, when really the message there was, it's since been reset. And April 10th is still the release date.
Yes. So how is this impacting the physical copies, though? Because I know a lot of people are really excited about their physical versions, mm-hmm, of Final Fantasy VII Remake.
Absolutely. So what we originally heard was, okay, it might be delayed. Then we heard it's gonna be delayed. And now we've heard that Square Enix has shipped copies to the EU and Australia in hopes of meeting that April 10th release date, which is a week.
Right.
So they actually anticipate now that copies are going to get out into the wild. Now, I can't blame developers and publishers for not doing this. Final Fantasy VII Remake is an interesting one because the content in that game, while a completely new take on a game that is 20 years old plus...
It's 20 plus years 20 old.
20 plus years old. You know, the story, everybody knows the story.
Sure.
Like, the statute of limitations is up.
Is it really?
On Final Fantasy VII.
Are we
spoilers.
Sure?
I'm sure. Sephiroth's... and Cloud, they ride off into the sunset together, and
they're unicorns too, right?
Yes, unicorns.
I love it.
We have now efficiently spoiled Final Fantasy VII for you.
Hooray!
They acknowledge the fact that there are story beats in the game that people know that are not a secret.
Yes.
So I think they were probably feeling a little safer about shipping that out early.
It's not like shipping out Final Fantasy XV early,
right?
Or shipping out one of the, like, say you were. Let's say we were still operating with Final Fantasy 14, but Final Fantasy 11. Remember the discs?
I had it on PS2.
I think it was 2.
It was. I bought the hard drive.
Man.
I had my network adapter for SOCOM. And then I had the keyboard. I had the keyboard. I had this great Logitech keyboard. The keyboard itself slid out of this giant controller.
Yeah. Thing. I had the same one, actually. That
was great.
Man, we are old. Yeah.
So this week, Resident Evil 3 is due out.
Yes.
And Persona 5 Royal was due out. We actually were told that Persona 5 Royal might be delayed. Our copy of the Collector's Edition did show up today.
It did. On Tuesday. It's very
so
pretty.
It arrived on time. It's great. We have the mask up in our office. Love that. Resident Evil 3, again, you might get your physical copy on time. You might not. So to circle back, you know, Square Enix is doing a solid to retailers who otherwise may have seen a lot of their customers shift to digital. I don't know that other publishers are going to do the same thing, but I think what we're in for is a disruption to day and date synchronization across between retail and digital.
Between physical and digital, which is interesting because we had, who did we have that conversation with? I think it might have been,
was it Matt?
Maybe it was Matt. It might have been my dad, actually.
Oh, we definitely did talk to your dad about this when we spoke with him yesterday, and we're checking in on your parents. The interesting thing, if we pull the camera out just a little bit, right? Because we're talking about this right now. We're talking about the end of March. We're talking about the beginning of April.
We've only been looking at and dealing with this problem for the last 3 weeks, three plus weeks. So it's not that long.
No, and if you only look at the first 3 weeks, what you're going to think is that games are going to do great as a result of this. Everybody's inside. Everybody is stuck at home. Games are going to do great. And I think in a very micro level, if your analysis is based on the 3 weeks, especially when you have Animal Crossing doing gangbusters, when you've got Doom Eternal. Exactly. That's done really well.
Yeah.
You know, if your analysis is localized to those three weeks and you extrapolate that, sure, that's great.
But that's not how this works. And it's not how a more macro level of economics is going to end up playing out. We have to look back in order to look forward. So one of the things that we really wanted to talk about today was what the Great Recession back in 2008, it can really show us about what the game industry may have to go through in 2020. So in 2008, I was going back to school. Mm-hmm. I'd only been out of school for about a year at that time, out of university. For about a year, so I went back to school to become a designer and lasted approximately 2 semesters. That's a conversation that you can ask me about. That's a conversation for over drinks.
Yes, but like over Zoom or Skype or...
Yeah, but like Discord. Later.
Yeah.
Like next year.
Next year. So I was living in Rochester, New York. Mm-hmm. Danielle and I owned our first house.
That house was so cute.
Oh, thank you. And when everything hit, Paul had just been born.
Yeah, so, holy crap.
I was very lucky. I worked in a mid-sized arts organization. I worked for the Arts and Cultural Council for Greater Rochester. And we served small, mid-sized, and large arts organizations in the Greater Rochester area, which was a large area. It wasn't just Rochester. It wasn't just Monroe County, where Rochester is located. But it was a 10-county area at its widest. One of the grant programs I managed was a 10-county grant program. And I will tell you that the arts felt it immediately, because the arts rely on government funding.
Yeah.
And when government shifts priorities, and when government funding is taxed and shifted elsewhere, the arts get deprioritized.
Yeah, always.
When we also relied on the gifts from wealthy individual donors, and those...
So, philanthropic donors.
Exactly. And a lot of that money is based on how well the stock market is doing. Their money is invested in whether it's in funds or individual stocks. And if the stock market takes a nosedive, which it well did.
100% you know, did.
It took a hard hit in 2008. Well, people were seeing their investments underwater. People were seeing their mortgages underwater. And we were lucky.
Suddenly their houses were overvalued and they weren't going to be able to pay their own mortgages back. Were they able to sell?
And I will tell you that we purchased that house in 2004.
That very cute house.
Yes, that very cute house we purchased in 2004. We put thousands upon thousands of dollars. We redid the kitchen. We redid all the windows. And we barely broke even. Like, we broke even and got a little bit back. But we certainly didn't recoup our investment in the house.
And that, so, when you guys sold, that was 2009.
So we were still in the thick of it. Like, the housing market had not recovered yet. So what you start seeing, but the word, we talked about doing this. I'm going to make this our first official segment. Our first official one of these. So we had talked about doing segments on the show and calling one of them Term Sheet.
I like it.
So, and this is a section where a segment where we take popular terms that you might hear that are financial related and kind of explain what they mean. Because there are a lot of terms when you're discussing finances that you don't understand what they mean. And the one I'm gonna land on today is furlough.
So, you know what's interesting is I had no idea what a furlough was until I met you, because it was just nothing. I'd never seen it happen before. I'd never seen anyone be furloughed at a company before. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. It's that I don't know if there is a distinct difference in the way that employers in Canada are able to pay or not pay their employees, or if it's just something that I had the distinct privilege to not ever experience myself. Maybe it's because I worked in high tech.
Sure. And furloughing, it's not very common. It only happens in times of severe and economic distress. And I hope to God after 2008 that I would never see it again in my lifetime. But here we are. And typically what furloughing means is that you're asking your employees, or you're telling your employees, that in order to not lay people off, you're going to mandate that one day a week that they will not work and they will not get paid for it. Or 1 week out of four, they will not work and won't get paid for it. So you're reducing somebody, assuming that that lasts for a full 12-month period, you're reducing somebody's salary by 25%.
And that is the very definition of underemployment.
Or, I'm sorry, if it's 1 week in four, it's 25%. If it's 1 day a week, it's 20%. But we're talking about 20 to 25% of your salary.
That's significant.
Now, in the United States, again, this isn't an issue in Canada, if an employer chooses to furlough and that employee receives benefits, they won't lose their benefits. They won't be forced to go on COBRA.
Oh, okay. So,
and it happened a lot in the arts, and we're seeing it now in the arts. We're seeing, you know, the Metropolitan Opera laid people off. Film at Lincoln Center laid people off. These are big arts organizations. Now, the challenge of big arts organizations means they're not nimble. Smaller, mid-sized arts organizations can make that flexibility. They might not have a lot of overhead, but large organizations are affected. But mid-sized organizations, especially, which aren't quite as nimble as small organizations and don't have the financial wherewithal and large endowments of large organizations.
Especially if they're not centered in an arts capital like New York.
Exactly. So anybody that relies on donations, whether that's from the state, whether that's from grant makers. Now, grant makers, again, the way grant making works is you are making grants off of the interest on your endowment.
Right.
So if the endowments take a hit, the amount you have available to give away in grants, if there's anything left, is severely diminished. And then you've got individual donors, and this is where we're going to segue back to the game industry. Individual donors have less disposable income to make their charitable giving. Now, let's take that back to the average gamer, right?
Yes. This is the important portion of the conversation that we started to have last night with my dad that we're bringing back into this conversation. Yep. We had some good conversations with my dad last night.
We did, and it kind of inspired me to include this in the show today when I was working up the notes for us to talk about. And I'm glad you were happy about this, because I'm really passionate about this subject. What we're seeing right now with Animal Crossing and with Doom Eternal is huge spikes because people are at home. That's right. Again, it's a microcosm of what we're going to see in the long term. And the game industry is going to feel this as a huge wave, not a ripple, but a wave down the line, as will every other luxury or non-essential purchase.
And I can build on that. So we were talking about arts, right? Let's talk about fashion for a second. I subscribe to Vogue Business because Vogue Business is some of the most important investigative journalism being done about the fashion industry for fashion leaders. And what a lot of what I've been seeing within the luxury goods sector of fashion, because remember that fashion isn't just about luxury. Fashion is also, you know, the trickle down effect for things like department stores and, you know, bargain bins and, you know, different kinds of fast fashion brands. The luxury brands felt it immediately. Not a little bit immediately, but a lot immediately. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are making strategic shifts in the way that they're rolling out their next season of clothing so that it is not going to be as much of a financial hit. But I would not be surprised if we saw some of the biggest names. We're talking about the Chanels, the Balenciagas, and everything like that. I would not be surprised if we saw those couture houses either taking a temporary shutdown or really, really, really streamlining in order to make sure that they survive. You know, these are houses that have been around for a really, really long time. Mm-hmm. So I would be ashamed to see them completely shutter, but they have enough money in the bank that, you know, that's probably not going to happen. But they are going to have to streamline the way that they are approaching their manufacturing.
Absolutely. So what we're going to see is that as people are furloughed, as people lose their jobs, and we have heard about thousands upon thousands of people losing their jobs.
Just in America.
Yep.
And this isn't even including my home country, but it's a little different in Canada.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to see people with diminished disposable income.
Just like we did in 2008.
Just like we did in 2008. And that is going to affect the gaming industry. Now, it's interesting. 2008 wasn't a console launch year.
No.
But 2020 is.
Yes. And I think that the closer that we get to console launches, we're going to have people that are going to have to either make a choice not to buy one at all, or they are going to have to do an either-or purchase, and they're going to have to potentially wait for a sale. Wait for a bundle and wait for a sale, because it's too much money to put down for a luxury good.
And the people who do decide to do it, they're going to have to put money away. It's going to take them longer. It's going to be harder for them.
So it's not going to be an impulse buy. We are going to see... We talked about mm-hmm. this. I think it was maybe last week. It was on one of the episodes from the last couple of weeks. But we talked about how that... It was with Steph.
Okay.
We talked about it
with Steph. Episode one.
It was officially episode one. We talked about how if folks do not have that kind of money, they are not going to impulsively spend it,
mm-hmm.
even digitally. And the digital spending is where the impulse buying tends to happen now, because as we talked
about. Oh man, I love that cosmetic. I'm totally going to buy that skin.
Yeah, that's likely not going to happen nearly as much. So let's talk a little bit more about how free-to-play is going to work into this.
I think the games that are going to benefit greatly from usage. Now, you remember, this doesn't necessarily translate into revenue, mm-hmm. but usage are games where you're monetizing only on cosmetics.
Yeah.
I'm really interested to see, and a little nervous about, how pay-gated free-to-play games are going to fare.
That's going to be a little tricky. I think that games like... I mean, Gems of War is not pay-gated. That game should not be nearly as good as it is. That game is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That little match 3 RPG is so much fun. And there are monetization pieces to it, but it's not enough to keep you away. But there are going to be things like, I don't know... Another free-to-play game that I used to play quite a bit was Cookie Jam.
Mm-hmm.
That game is going to see some diminishment, I think, because, yeah. you know, at a certain point, you have to be paying to unlock these power-ups, because otherwise you just, like, there's no way to beat the level.
Yep. And that's how a lot of those pay-gated free-to-play games are structured. I think the places where are best positioned
mm-hmm.
for this... I keep coming back to Xbox Game Pass and Xbox Game Pass Ultimate.
Yes.
Again, it is a very good deal.
It is such a good deal. And when
you're
paying
$15 a month, if you're like, all right, well, $15 a month, I can probably swing this. Or I don't have to buy any new games for the rest of the year. I can kind of wait for sales, because we know games drop in price relatively quickly.
That decay curve, though.
That decay curve. And that might push people, and this might ultimately be, you know, in favor for my or in Microsoft's favor, because you just carry that Game Pass Ultimate subscription forward. We know that every game on Xbox Series X is going to work with every Xbox One game, including the ones that were in Game Pass.
That's right.
Including those games that you've been getting with Games with Gold, those 360 games you got with Games with Gold, those handful of OG Xbox games that you got with Games with Gold.
So we're just mostly talking about you, though, right? Because you get all those games.
I mean, I do, but I don't think I'm alone. I think that there are people who subscribe to those services that click that button every, you know, for Game Pass, it's twice a month. You get those downloads.
Yeah, I 100% forget almost every month. I just figure I'll play all your games.
There you go. That's fair. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. I think that where we're going to see some challenge.
Yeah, exactly.
Is free-to-play games that are monetized, where you've got a subscription fee. I think Final Fantasy XIV is going to do fine. But I think they might have some challenges with $20 and $30 mounts.
Yeah, I think that, well, I mean, already, I get visibly uncomfortable thinking about laying down $30. No matter how cool the mount is.
Spriggan carrying you in around a basket, though.
I mean, Easter mounts are really cool, but hear me out. That's a lot of money just to be putting down for one cosmetic mm-hmm. versus... If I pop into another game and I'm dropping $5-$10 on a skin or a cosmetic of some kind, that's going to have some real impact in the way on whether or not I even play the game, because mm-hmm. I get to look the way I want to look, because I get, you know, the gun I want, or I get the, you know, like the haircut that I want, mm-hmm. you know, those kinds of things are just like you were talking about. Even if the active users doesn't necessarily equate to revenue, those MAUs, those DAUs, those are metrics that really do matter.
Mm-hmm. And people will remember. I remember every credit card company cut our credit limit back in 2008. Oof. And we were at a point where we were largely maxed out. Like, Daniel had gone through medical school. Yeah. And we were not as careful as we should have been. And Discover was the only one that didn't cut our credit limit. And I remember that, right? And I think that games are going to have that same yes. role. I think people who go to Fortnite and, like, I can enjoy Fortnite and I can maybe buy a battle pass every couple of months.
Sure.
As my expenditure.
Yeah. Are as my remember, gaming treat.
Right. They're going to remember, like, oh, Fortnite was here for me, right? Yeah. That was the game I went to when I couldn't afford anything
else. Those are the games that help create.
Right. So great. Our guest today is Dave Oshry. He is currently the CEO of New Blood Interactive, the publisher of such.
It is time.
It's time to talk to Oshry. Let's go get him.
How the heck are you? Oshry to the show.
I'm doing okay. I'm quarantined here in New Zealand, which seems a lot better than being quarantined in the States.
Not wrong there.
We're quarantined in Jersey, so you know what that's like. Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't want to be in Jersey ever, let alone stuck in Jersey.
Okay, so. Long Island boy.
Yeah, how you doing?
That's so good. Also, your rental house is gorgeous, so I wouldn't mind being quarantined in a beautiful rental house like that too.
I got very lucky. Yeah, so I got an awesome rental here on the beach in New Zealand. And I'm, you know, I'm used to working from home, even though I work at Rocketworks down here, you know, Dean Hall Studio, and we have a studio in the city, and it's like a 20-minute drive from here. And I don't mind going to the office, but I really don't mind not going to the office. And we've all transitioned to work from home, and it's been great because it's basically what I've been doing the last 5-6 years with New Blood. Anyway, I'm like, virtual teams. That's, you know, we don't have an office for New Blood. We were about to open one actually in Pennsylvania when this whole thing hit. With the lease was on my desk. And I was like, listen, we're going to have to postpone because with the world's on fire right now. So now it's funny seeing the whole world transition, the whole game dev world transition to how, like, you know, small companies like we've been doing it for the last 5 years, basically using Discord and Slack and, you know, all kinds of funny new tools for them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know. Do you remember Campfire?
Oh, yeah, Campfire.
Oh, my God.
That goes back.
Back in the day.
Yeah, oh, Campfire. Yeah, I remember Kotaku used that. I think they still do.
We used it at Rip 10, too. Slack.
Oh, God.
Chad decided that he wanted to use it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, speaking of that, that's a pretty good segue.
Yes.
I want to know, Dave, everybody wants to know, the hell's your background story? What's your origin story in gaming? How the hell did you get to where you are today?
Everybody knows my origin story already. So once upon a time, me and Mike were at COD XP 2011. Mm-hmm. Oh, I mean before that shit.
Yeah, before that.
And I met Mike, and he said, "I'm not Dave Oshry," and I said, "No, but you will be soon, young Padawan."
The truth is.
Oh, I know. I heard that story.
Oh my God, he was so fit back then.
I'm working on it, man.
He is.
Like I still have pictures on my phone as inspiration.
Quarantine, Mike. He's gonna get it.
Oh, he's gonna get swole. Don't worry.
Anyway, so once upon a time, so back in, I grew up in the car business, as anybody who asked me will know. I did not grow up studying to, you know, do video games and stuff. When I was a kid, I didn't know video games were a thing that, you know, little Jewish boys from Long Island could do. I thought video games were made by Japanese men in suits from Japan. I grew up in the car business. I was working, at the family dealership, and then, my old man died. And I was like, I'm too young to take over a dealership. I was like 21, 22 at the time, and I was finishing up school at Hofstra University, my business degree, and I didn't know what to do with my life, so I was playing a whole lot of World of Warcraft. This is about 2008, 2009, you know, the heyday of World of Warcraft. It was basically a second job. I had, you know, the family had decided to sell the dealership, and I was working at like a used car lot out on Long Island and basically, playing Warcraft as my other job. You know, I'd come home and play WoW all night. And I met this warrior, on my server in my guild, and his name was Rip 10. And it turned out to be a dude named Chad, and he ran a gaming blog called Rip 10. And I said, hey man, I got some free time on my hands. All I do is sell used cars and play WoW. I'd like to write for your gaming blog. Can I write for your gaming blog? And he's like, ugh. I was like, maybe. So I wrote a test review to him for Dragon Age Origins. I don't think it ever got published, but I love Dragon Age Origins.
So good.
As anybody who knows me knows, my favorite genre of game is isometric CRPGs, right? I love, you know, Fallout, Baldur's Gate, Pillars of Eternity.
Same.
You know, that kind of stuff. You know, the isometric turn-based CRPGs is my favorite genre. Right, you know, and right after that is actually retro FPS. People usually think games like Doom and stuff are my favorite, but they're actually my second favorite genre. And he's like, yeah, sure, that's good enough or whatever. And I was like, cool, do I get video games like early now to write reviews for? And he was like, maybe.
That's the most Chad answer.
Yeah, and I was like, it was, you know, because back then it was, you know, writing about games was so cool. I mean, you know, nowadays, I mean, so, but back in 2009, getting a video game early to review was like the coolest thing in the world.
I feel
like
totally
that's why a lot of people get into blogging about games, right? And the first game that I got sent to me from Sandbox Strategy, one of my favorite PR agencies. I'm still friends with a lot of the people that work there now.
They're good people.
Awesome people. Yeah.
And it was, can you guess what game it was?
Probably, they were repping Sega at the time.
Yes, keep going.
All right, this is 2009?
Mm-hmm. Well, 2010, late 2009.
I hope it wasn't Shadow the Hedgehog.
No, that was like 2006.
I love that time dilation is definitely a
Sonic,
thing for Mike.
But with a gun.
That's not
good. Sega, I don't know, was there a Yakuza game out around then?
No, keep going. It actually, if you, it ties into the isometric CRPG thing that I was into, but it wasn't that kind of a game at all. It was a company that was used to making those kind of games.
Oh, wait, so who's making them? Obsidian?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Obsidian. Was it Alpha Protocol? Sega.
Yes, Alpha Protocol.
Oh, that explains your love for that game.
Yes, well, I mean, listen, also, it's a cult classic, unpolished gem of a game. I will defend Alpha Protocol to the end of time. You could still go find my YouTube review on it. It was either on the Rip10 YouTube or my YouTube. I gave it an 8 out of 10. I love that game. It was a janky mess, but it was awesome. And yeah, Alpha Protocol was the first game I ever reviewed and first thing I ever published and wrote about as a professional video game industry person or whatever. You know, glorified blogger. And from there, it just took off. I became the only person writing on Rip10, and then we found some friends, and they all started writing. Next thing you know, I was the editor. Next thing you know, I owned it. Next thing you know, I like sold it back to Chad. Next thing you know, Mike was there, mm-hmm. And I was writing for like Kotaku and PC Gamer and VG247 freelancing. So I'd become like a popular video game, you know, journo blogger dude. But I had a marketing background. You know, I wasn't a writer. And I look back at some of my writing back then, and I was like, oof. You know, I got popular for basically writing everything. You know, my thing was just like all caps and exclamation points and just being basically. If you look at my Twitter today, just imagine like that, but like writing about
like
writing
articles.
Video game. Yeah, like articles and video game reviews back in 2010, 2011, which was a really magical time to be writing.
It really was. Those were my first years too.
Yeah, it was a lot of us. There's like a class of like 2008, 2009, and all of us are like doing really awesome stuff in games right now. I look at people like, you know, Andrea, Nick Chester, mm-hmm. you know, John Drake, and, you know, it's just like, wow, everybody's really out there doing stuff. And where was I going with that? I lost it.
I lost my
train of thought. Oh, 2011. Yeah, 2010, 2011, a great time to be writing about games. Like, I was one of the first people in the world to play Skyrim.
Oh, like, I remember waking up. Like, hey, Mike, I wrote a story about Skyrim on the site. Okay. I don't remember what it was, but it was you got hooks on something early.
Yeah, so I found vampires.
Oh, right.
And Bethesda, who always likes to control their PR conversation, had promised that story to G4 TV. They'd like, the vampires are in Skyrim, right? Because they hadn't confirmed that they're back from Oblivion.
Mm-hmm.
I snuck into a demo that I wasn't supposed to be at QuakeCon because nobody's ever going to tell me not to go into a fucking press demo, right? They were like, who the fuck are
I've
you?
Been, I was
like,
no, along for the ride on a couple of those. It was the most magical thing.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's like, what? Like, if you're a reporter, you just fucking, I'm going to report. I don't know. And like, I'm sorry, you're not important enough to come. Okay, whatever. Yeah, okay, bye. I'm just going to walk by you and go play the game. You know, reporter reports, right? And I had, you know, I got into this demo, and it was like six other people. It was like, you know, it was all the big outlets. It was like Game Informer, IGN, GameSpot, and me from some no-name blog called Rip10 and Todd Howard walking around, and I'm like, don't pretend, just blend in, just pretend that you're supposed to be here, which was so funny, because then when Bethesda had to put out all the previews for these big-name sites, it was just like, this one, Rip10, you know? However, because my previews were kind of nuts, I always wrote these very Gonzo Hunter Thompson style previews where I talked about the event as well as, you know, my experiences and then my own personal life and stuff. When I wrote these things, it was like, you know, 10 pages, 10,000 words. It was published way after everybody else's. And I found like Maik the Liar. I was a huge Elder Scrolls fan. I found Vampires. It blew up on all the Elder Scrolls fan sites and stuff. It crashed Rip10. It got like 10 million page views. And it was really cool to see that, like, wow, you know, this is the kind of access, if you can get this kind of access and write what you know, people will gravitate towards that. And that, you know, kind of started the whole, you know, people following me for my writing and my personality and stuff. And it kind of just grew from there. However, I was not long for the video game writing world because, like I said, it was not my background. I'm not a writer, not a journalist, right? I went to school for marketing and business. So one of the stories I had written about, you know, in the whole 2009, 2010 period, which was a magical time for video games, as we said, there were these Danish dudes called Interceptor Entertainment, and they were trying to do a full-on reboot of Duke Nukem 3D in Unreal Engine, and they were calling it Duke Nukem Reloaded. And it was this dude named Frederick, and he had gotten some modders together, and he put up some screenshots, and he was like, we're trying to make Duke Nukem in 3D in Unreal Engine, and we really want to release it, and we need your money to help. Please donate. Y'all.
This is before Kickstarter. It's important to point out that, like, this is pre-Kickstarter.
Yeah, he had the website with forums and everything. Duke Nukem Reloaded. And the screenshots looked pretty good, and I was a Duke fan. And I love those old, you know, 3D Realms Apogee games. And I had stayed in touch with Fred. And he was like, yeah, Dave, you know, I've been, you know, I like your stories and stuff. And, you know, I hear you could do, you know, you're like a marketing guy and stuff. You know, how would you like to, you know, get involved with us, you know, with this thing if you're not doing, you know, writing anymore about games? You know, because I had decided that I was going to transition off of writing about games and try to do other stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know. Maybe he's like, well, we got in touch with this legendary publisher. Fred's really good about blowing stuff out of proportion. Sounds amazing. And, you know, we think, you know, if you can be like an investor or a marketing guy, I was like, well, I gave you $200, but okay, I'm an investor, sure. you know, I think you could be a really good fit and help us, you know, with your popularity and stuff like that. I was like, yeah, sure, man. And he's like, okay, so we'll get on a call. He's like, I'm not going to tell you who it is. And I was like, okay, whatever. What is this legendary publisher you're talking about? And we get on the phone, and it turns out to be Terry from Apogee. And he's like, yeah, you know, Apogee Software. I'm like, this is like the new Apogee Software, right? This isn't like that, you know, it wasn't even like Scott Miller and George at the time from 3D mm-hmm. Realms. It was Terry who had split off Apogee in 2009 as a new Apogee, just with the name and stuff. And he had taken some of the IPs with him. But as you know, because I know you've dug way deep into the whole, you know, Randy Gearbox.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. Realms,
rabbit hole. At the time, they had the rights to do a bunch of Duke Nukem offshoot games. And one of them was a game they were going to call Duke Nukem Mass Destruction or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And Fred was like, yeah, so we want to do this Duke Nukem game and we need like $600,000 in 2 years and stuff. You know, would you be interested in getting involved? And I was like, hell no. This was before Duke Forever. Like I said, this was probably like 20. This might have been right after Duke Forever or like right before. This was, yeah, it was 2011. Late 2011.
When did Duke Forever finally come out?
It was 2011 or 2010? I think it was 2011.
I think it might have been 2011, yeah.
Oh, Duke Forever.
Oh.
Yeah.
What a hot mess.
Yeah, and I was, whatchamacallit, and I was like, hell no. I don't want anything to do with that IP. Thank you for your time.
Yep, 2011. Like,
oh, yeah. And also, I was like, I didn't have that much money. What the fuck? I was like, I had given you $200 as a donation to your fucking Duke.
Now you're an investor. Surprise!
Yeah, Kickstarter thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and we were about to get off the phone. I've told this story a million times, and I go, I was like, do you guys have the rights to Rise of the Triad? And Terry's like, yeah. And I was like, well, let's fucking make that game. And Fred's like, yeah, we can make that game for like $100,000. And I was like, okay. I was like, I can get that together maybe. Shit, fuck it. Let's do it. And next thing you know, I'm the marketing director and lead investor on a Rise of the Triad reboot. And we spend 6 months like getting stuff together. We announce it at QuakeCon 2012. It gets, because back then you could make noise with indie stuff, right? There wasn't, you know, Kickstarter hadn't happened yet. The Steam indie extravaganza hadn't happened yet. Everything was still a walled garden. Yeah. So, you know, announcing a reboot of a shooter from the 90s back then, we were on everything. We got, you know, our trailer was a Machinima exclusive. If you can remember when those were still.
Oh, yes.
What's a Machinima?
Yeah. Oh my. You know what's really sad is the Machinima nuked their whole YouTube channel.
Yeah. That was rough.
And so the Rise of the Triad reveal trailer is gone now. There was a mirror of it on the Interceptor channel, but it's gone.
Oh,
so,
wow.
But back then in 2012, like I planned the whole reveal. I had never done video game marketing, PR, anything before. I was just doing what I saw, you know, my friends, you know, like Tinsley and Sandbox, you know, doing like, okay, let's. I was working with Tom Ole at the time from Evolve, and he was on the ground with me at QuakeCon. Fucking Crescente leaked the announcement for Kotaku of like a few hours early, and I was like, you son of a bitch. We were sending him emails. It ended up being a huge boon to us because it was like, you know, Rise of the Triad reboot about to be revealed at QuakeCon because they had found the Twitter account. Somebody had found the Twitter account that I made for it.
Oh, right.
Like,
I remember this.
Like 5 in the morning, and Crescente found, like, somebody sent that to Kotaku, and he wrote that story and sent, you know, and did his Brian due diligence and sent an email to Tom saying, hey, just want you to know we're running with this story. And we ended up actually pushing the reveal back like a few hours to get stuff ready. And I was like, wow, we got like our game like leaked and stuff. This is like going to be a big deal.
I think you texted me at that time, like right after it leaked. You're like, ah, fuck, don't say anything, but blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, and it was, we were trying to, and it was really cool just, you know, because we did it like a game reveal. And it blew up. And it, you know, over the next 2 years, we developed a Rise of the Triad motherfucking reboot, and we put it out in 2013. It did pretty okay. In the meantime, we also did re-releases of Duke 1, Duke 2, Duke on iOS, Duke Manhattan Project, which I was a really big fan of, got that, all those games on Steam. And back then, getting stuff on Steam was not easy. I went to GDC 2012, and we had to go meet with Valve to, like, try to beg to get Rise of the Triad on Steam, and back then Greenlight had just become a thing.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I'll never forget this. I get into, you know, I was doing an interview with Unreal Engine at the time. There's some pictures back then. It's insane just thinking about like what I was doing like 8-10 years ago. Just like, please let me be on Steam. I was in a meeting with Unreal Engine, and Dan and Terry from Apogee came in. They're like, well, we met with Steam, and they said they want us to put the game on Greenlight. They think it'd be really good for Greenlight. And I was like, what? I was like, you put my ass on Steam Greenlight? It's fucking Rise of the Triad. It's a goddamn classic. It's a reboot of a classic, and we're putting the classic game as a – what? It's perfect. I was like, get me, like, bring – let me talk to the Valve guys. Let me talk to the Valve guys. This is bullshit. I'm not taking no for an answer. And I walk in there, and I sit down, and it's with Nate Blue from Valve, who's a cool dude. And this was the first time I ever met him. And he was like, well, you know, we think it's a really good fit for Greenlight, and we don't think the pre-order bonus of the classic game is, you know, you're gonna be able to put the main game on, but we don't think the pre-order bonus is, you know, a good of a, you know, we want to put that on Greenlight, which is Rise of the Triad 95, the original game.
Yeah.
And whatchamacallit, I was like, well, there's got to be something we could do that. It's perfect. You know, the original game is a pre-order bonus for the game. You know, they fit so well together. We could market them together. And he's like, well, what are other companies doing? He's like, well, Sega, you know, does this thing where they have all their classic games in a collection, and they've got like the Sega Master Collection. We really think that's an attractive package and stuff for Valve. And I'm like, well, Apogee's got rights to a bunch of other games. We could put a bunch of other games on Steam, right? Right, Dan? Right, Terry? And they just kind of nod along. And I'm like, yeah, we can do that. We'll do the same thing. We'll put a bunch of old Apogee games up on as, and we'll call it the Apogee fucking Mega Retro Collection, and we'll put that. Is that cool? Is that, can we do that? And Nate was like, yeah, I think that would work. Yeah, sweet. And I was like, cool, we'll do that. Done. And that's how the Apogee Throwback Pack became a thing, because they had the right. They also had the rights to Blake Stone, which is one of my favorite classic Apogee games, and not much else. They had the rights to Raptor, but not a lot of other 3D Realms. Scott and George at the time still had the rights to all the other like old Apogee 3D Realms games, which they ended up putting on Steam as the 3D Realms Anthology a little bit later down the line, and got, you know, beat up by Bethesda because they also thought it would be okay to put like Doom and fucking Wolf 3D on there.
Oh no, that's not good.
Oh no, baby, yeah, what is that, you doing?
Yeah. Man, imagine what
Uncle Pete said to that.
Yeah, I bet.
I hope. So I can imagine, like 10 years ago, it's hard to imagine that it was the Wild West. Like, we've come really so far in a decade.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and back. I'm glad to have had to go through those hurdles back then, because I think it really kind of, you know, it taught me a lot about, you know, working in games business development as opposed to what I had been doing before, which was just, you know, writing and marketing, and I think it helped me.
Yeah. So I want to kind of fast forward a little bit. Obviously, you moved to New Zealand. New Blood Interactive is doing super well. Your booth at PAX East was amazing.
It really was.
It may have been the last booth that anybody ever has, because who knows when we're going to get to go to a convention again.
Remember conventions?
I remember conventions. I like.
I remember conventions.
I remember. Pepperidge Farm.
Yeah,
remembers.
We could definitely. Yeah, I'm sorry. I was going super slow with my story. People ask me, and I always like start at the beginning.
No, it's your story is fascinating.
That's
and
why
I'm glad
we
you
asked.
Shared it. Yeah, that's why we asked.
Well, I wanted to go back to when me and Mike met, because that was when me and Mike met, because Mike was the editor at Rip 10 and I was, I guess, the, what did Chad call me, the consigliere or whatever.
Yeah, it was
the mob thing. And me and Mike were working together as writers, and then when I got into the, so I'll fast forward, so that was, you know, Rise of the Triad was the first game I put on Steam, and, you know, fast forward from that, I after Rise of the Triad, I didn't want to work with any of those people again. We all hated each other. So me and my buddy Aaron went and started our own company, and that became New Blood.
And Aaron is also a former Rip 10 writer.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. And, you know, and Aaron ended up down, you know, he's from New Zealand, and that's part of how I ended up down here. But, you know, fast forward, we started New Blood, you know, in 2014. Fast forward 5-6 years later, we've put out Dusk, a medieval, Maximum Action, we're working on Faith. Bunch of other games, Unfortunate Spaceman, Super Galaxy Squadron, and we're like in, you know, a fun little indie studio developer publisher thing, right? We're, you know, kind of well known. We have a lot of fun. People love our shit. And then I got the opportunity again. During that time, I got helped get Aaron a job with Dean Hall, as you know, of DayZ fame.
Yep.
Of not finishing DayZ fame. down here in New Zealand. So I'll talk shit about Dean all day. I love him. Aaron moved from the North Island to the South Island here to work with Dean, and he was working with him for a few years, and, you know, New Blood was doing pretty well. But I had come down here and visited a few times, and the opportunity came up, like, hey, Dave, would you like to come here and help, you know, work on stuff at Rocketworks? And I was like, you know, New Blood was, this was after Dusk came out, so I was like, we were chilling, right? New Blood was doing really well. And I was like, yeah, I get to move to New Zealand, you know, and work with my friends again? Sure, as long as I can keep running New Blood. So I did it. I just up and fucking did it. You know, I didn't have, you know, no wife, no kids, you know, no real attachments. I had sold my house. I was living, you know, in an apartment in San Diego. And I was like, yeah, I'll move to New Zealand. And here I am now. So now, you know, fast forwarded through the fun Mike years, through the... That really was the Wild West of games writing.
It was wild. Like, coming up first, you know, I love Ken McCown. He gave me my first writing job at CTGD.
Right. Yeah, N4G, everybody's favorite. Is that website still a thing?
It is, and CTGD, I mean, they still do the N4G radio show, but Ken, I will always be indebted to, and I'll always be indebted to you, because you connected me with Rip 10, where I landed the... The Darksiders interview, the THQ interview.
Yeah, that's right, the THQ one that blew you up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember. I think I wrote the. They used to call me Johnny Headline, because I would take people's, you know, reviews, and they're like, no, this needs a way bigger, stupider headline.
Make it punchy, Dave.
Yeah, we'd bring him in with the stupid, you know, clickbaity headline, and then keep him with the great reporting. You know, I'd call it a lost leader. And brilliant. You know, so here I am now. I am the studio director at Rocketworks Dunedin. I am still the head of New Blood. So here at Rocketworks, I'm working on a bunch of, you know, indie and double A stuff. Dean's working on a big triple A survival crafting thing up in the new Auckland studio that just opened. If you've probably read about it, it's like, you know, the biggest, most expensive Auckland office that has ever existed for gaming and tech. You know, Dean gonna Dean. He didn't have to sell any of his Lambos to fund it. And then, you know, and then at New Blood, you know, we're working on like 7-8 games now.
Wild.
So between the two, so I went from a dude blogging about Alpha Protocol to a guy producing 11 video games across two continents in the span of the last 10 years. And it's been fun and it's been wild. But the good news is I get to still talk to you guys I have known for almost that long.
Yeah. Wow.
I'm really surprised that our paths didn't cross before they did. Like, I've been in this industry since 2010, right? Because I started at Gaming Angels. I'm really surprised I didn't run into either of you until, like, 2015.
You skipped the whole Gunner years, too.
I did. Well, everybody forgets about Gunner.
Oh, we didn't. We definitely told. Yeah. We definitely told on you a little.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was in between... that was after Rise of the Triad. I was doing that at the same time as New Blood, back when New Blood was like a part-time thing, and I was just kind of chilling off Rise of the Triad royalties at the time, because you put a game out on Steam in 2013, and you chill.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, well, I went broke making that game. Like, so remember when Fred said it was going to cost $100,000?
Uh-huh. Definitely did.
I think the whole budget for that game was like $400,000, so I emptied everything I had into that game, and I wrote a blog about it once. Mm-hmm. When that game launched at QuakeCon, I had negative... $2.52 in my bank account. The last thing I had did, I had sold my Jeep, I had sold my old man's watch to like fund the rest of the final few stages, and then getting to QuakeCon and making the booth and stuff. And then I'll never forget, I was like, it's gonna be fine, the game's gonna do, we've got a ton of pre-orders, it's gonna be fine. We had gotten like 25,000 pre-orders and stuff. When the game launched, it was already profitable. There was a story about it. I think it's still up, that, you know, we had done about 50,000 copies on launch, which is nuts today. Thinking about, if I tell indies that in 2020, that like we launched and we had sold 50,000 copies already with our janky ass 7 out of 10 reboot of a 6 out of 10 game from the 90s.
You made it better by a star, Dave.
Yeah, I used to call Rise of the Triad a D+ reboot of a C+ game from the 90s. You know, it's, you know, it's janky as fuck, but its heart was in the right place. And the fact that, you know, if that came, that came out before Steam user reviews, came out before like Greenlight and stuff. But that, if we put, I told people, if we would put out Rise of the Triad 2013 today, like we did in 2013, we'd all be homeless. You know, it was janky. It was buggy. It ran like shit. It was fun. It was like, it was, you know, it reviewed fine. You know, it got 5s and 6s, but also 7, 8s and a few 9s from crazy people. You know, it was like, I think the Metacritic was a 69, which was perfect.
That's nice.
There's nothing more on brand than that.
It was so on brand. But it did, but anyway, so it did fine. By the time it came out, it had been profitable. And I remember I got my first check from Apogee for it, and it was like $66,000. And I remember I showed it, I think I was at PAX right after that, and I showed it to Dana Cowley from Epic, who I was talking to about stuff, and I was like, we're gonna be all right, everything's gonna be okay. I was standing around with my girlfriend at the time, and I'm like, babe, it's gonna be okay, we're gonna make the money back. It really was the Wild West. Would I ever do that again? No, except when Dusk came out, I was also broke again. I really need to stop making myself go broke to put video games out. But I think
you need to separate the personal finances from the corporate finances.
Well, I'm not exactly good at business. I'm good at getting games out the door by any means necessary. But however, now I'm pretty sure that's the last time I'm going to go broke.
I'm going to make Dave's hope a that closer. That's Dave is
until,
a closer.
Dave's a closer.
Until the next time.
Until the next time. And we'll sit down and we'll have this same conversation. Hey, Dave, how'd that last launch go? Yeah, it was great. I definitely went broke again. God damn, yeah. Dave.
Hopefully not. Well, now I've got a lot of mouths to feed. You know, New Blood's, you know, 20, 30 developers across all of our
That's
games.
Amazing.
I've got a great creative director in David, who, you know, is the Dusk Dead. And, you know, it's a lot of other dudes, great QA team, and, you know, we do our own publishing, we do our own QA, we do our own development, we're a one-stop shop these days. And between that and Rocketworks, I am very, very busy boy.
So, Yeah, you are busy, but you're also finding time to make hilarious videos on the interwebs in your bathroom from your beautiful home in New Zealand.
With those great glasses.
With those great glasses. So, question, you know, you came
me
you came
and my
down.
Blindness alone.
Dude, I am just as blind. We'll compare diopters because I am
negative 9 in both eyes.
In your glasses or your contacts?
My contacts, and my glasses are even worse.
Oh yeah, dude, my contacts are negative 9.75.
Wow, yeah. You're worse than me.
We are two blind Jews. So
yeah, that's a good name. That's what we should name the podcast.
Two blind Jews. Wow. So we're renaming the podcast on the fly.
What? Two blind Jews
two blind
and this
Jews
chick?
And Amanda.
It's like two guys, a girl, in a pizza place.
Yeah, what's that? Oh my god.
That's a lot.
That?
Well, Ryan Reynolds was in that, so...
Oh my god, he was.
He's a good Canadian boy.
All right, so you make this video, and you like, we've been talking to people along the way about, like, all right, what do we do about our games during this crisis? And you had some pretty definitive opinions about this.
There was a rousing round of applause here after we both watched that video.
It's true.
Yeah, people were like texting me from the States and stuff, like, oh my god, I'm so proud of you. My mother, I was like, I made a 20-second drunk video in my bathrobe saying that companies shouldn't capitalize on a pandemic, and everyone was like, yes! Yes, queen! I was like, what? Is that all it takes? I was like, is that all it takes for everyone to give a round of applause? Like, I'm some fucking hero? It was really funny to see. But also, it's cool just because, you know, I guess a lot of, because I'm not attached to, there's, you know, I have no, you know, there is nobody above me. There are no strings on me. I don't have to watch what I say. I have the benefit of being able to go on Twitter and saying, hey, don't take advantage of people. Fuck you. When other mm-hmm. people don't, because, you know, they work for big, you know, big companies, publishers, developers, whatever it is.
That may or may not be taking advantage of people.
Hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it was. And I think it was cool because it started the conversation going and made people realize, because I had seen some people also, not only some people taking advantage, especially when I saw this, what I was talking about was after Steam announced that they had record-breaking numbers, a ton of developers went and just started putting their games on sale. You know, quarantine sale, coronavirus sale. Oh, my God, everybody, you know, there's record numbers on Steam because I live in that ecosystem, right? Yeah. I live within Steamworks and the Steam ecosystem. You know, mm-hmm. That's what I've done, you know, and only now, you know, New Blood's branching out into console and, you know, merchandising and stuff like that. But for the last, you know, 5 years, I've lived inside Steam and Steamworks. So I study that and I know that economy better than anybody else that I know. And when that happened, I saw a lot of developers rushing to put their games on sale. And I was like, that's not what you should be fucking doing during this time. And we're going to talk about the fact that I think the data now backs that up.
Yep.
Or is it basically, this isn't a time, this is, people don't have money, right? They have time, you know, they are not buying new games, they are digging into their backlog. Playtime will be up, spending will be down. And what you should be doing during this time is trying to help people, growing your communities. A lot of people do a really shitty job of, you know, like I was saying in my video, of having a community. People are really bad at community building, they're really bad at community interaction, they're bad at social. This is a great time to grow that, to get those numbers up. Those are rookie numbers.
Dave's the closer.
It's a great time to engage with the people who play your games. And I think, you know, New Blood has built our community and our, you know, our engagement from the ground up, just mm-hmm. one at a time, talking to people, join the Discord, play our games, get on the forums, you know, play with us, you know, here's some free shit, you know, we hate money. And you know, talk to, you know, it's a great time for community building because people are playing your games. They might not be buying your games, but people are going to be playing your games now more than ever. And I was really speaking towards, you know, my wheelhouse is indie and AA and stuff like that. I've never really worked in the AAA world. And I've, you know, so I wasn't really speaking to that. Although there were some big publishers and stuff doing the same thing. But what I saw consequently from that is a lot of people doing, you know, giving, you know, doing free giveaways, doing the deepest mm-hmm. discounts they could do just to have people play their games, and then doing sales, but also making the sales benefit charity. I saw Square Enix did that the other day with Deus Ex and stuff, and I was like, that's how you fucking do it. You know, this is a time to do community building, to help your employees as well. Especially because we are so blessed, especially if you work in digital, to basically not be affected by this. You know, we don't have an office. Nothing's going to stop our our profits from rolling in. You know, I get our royalty checks from, you know, our the stores that we sell our games on. Our we work remote already. Mm-hmm. We are blessed to be in the industry we're in. So like I was saying, we are very fortunate. I am especially very fortunate. I ended up in New Zealand and I've got a bunch of successful games out. I am not being hit by this pandemic, right? But the people who play my games fucking are. I talk to these people every day. My DMs are just a wasteland of, you know, all kinds of crazy memes and people, you know, trying to talk to me and stuff. And same with our Discord. And
the Steam forums and responding on the Steam forums. There's nothing like a Dave response.
Oh yeah, forms. Yeah. Where are save files stored? In the balls. It's just nasty. Some people ask me like, how do I do social media like you? I'm like, well, you can't just be like, you know, start replying to people in all caps and stuff. You know, like that's me, right? And people also ask me like, why don't you have a community manager and stuff like that? I'm like, I can't just pay someone to be me and reply to all these people like me. I'm like, go be Dave. Like that's not a thing that I can ask people to do. Because, you know, I'm authentic. I'm just being me, which I have the ability to be me. Like, not every brand manager or whatever can just, like, be there, you know, be themselves and tell people to go fuck themselves on social media and be like, ha ha ha, they'd get dragged for that.
A little bit.
It's true, but well, can we go back to just point out, like, how you're technically correct that the save files are stored in the balls?
I mean, technically, yes.
And technically correct is, in fact, the best kind of correct.
Yeah, scientifically correct.
Scientifically correct.
But like I was saying, so the people, you know, the people that, for me, the most important people in, you know, this, I mean, I'm super, everybody knows I'm super consumer forward. I'm a big consumer advocate, and the people I care about the most are the people that pay money for our games. You know, those people are the hit hardest right now. People just, you know, working class people who just love our games and shit, and that's their escape during this. And they're home and they're playing our games. And there's people who wish they could be playing our games. You know, I've looked at Dusk for a long time. I've been waiting for it to go on sale. I'll just be like, fuck it, here, take a free copy. Or here's some free Steam keys. Like, I don't give a shit. You know, because in the long run, I will be rich in memes and engaged consumers that love our shit. You know, it's not the time to be making money. And I think more importantly, even if people thought it was, even if you're going to try to be scummy, and it's not necessarily scummy, some people have the best intentions. Some people need the money. There's developers that need money too. They're like, we're putting our games on sale because it might be a really good time. Maybe we can make some money. And I'm not going to fault anybody. I'm not going to fault anybody for trying to make money.
You got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, if you rush to run like a, you know, a pandemic sale when you saw, you know, record numbers, you know, hey, fuck you, this isn't the time for that, which is basically what I was saying. And it's, you know, it's a much better time. And I think what we can get into now is the fact that the data is supporting the fact that,
yes,
you know, people don't have money right now, but what they do have is time. So, you know, spending is down, play time is up. And it's a great time to get engaged with your community, which is what I was saying. And thankfully, the data is backing me up. So much like the father in Far Cry 5, I was right.
Holy shit, do we just end on that?
I think we just end on that.
Yeah. Holy fuck, that was amazing.
All right. Dave, we definitely want to have you back on at some point, because I think that you have a lot of, I mean, you've always been very data focused. You've always, through all of the amusing memes, like, you know your shit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I really want to have you come back and talk contracts and talk about like publisher structures and things like that.
Baby. We can talk about that for ages.
Absolutely. So we'll have you back on soon if that works for you. But this has been really wonderful. We're so grateful, because especially because the time difference is so weird, because it is Wednesday already where you are.
It's
Wednesday
tomorrow.
Midday.
It's tomorrow
where you are. Yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah, it is Wednesday at 1 p.m. Oh, and I have a leadership meeting to go to for RocketWorks, so I am going to go.
Okay, give us one sec here. We'll wrap up.
Yeah, and we can cut this down. This isn't live, so we can edit.
Yeah.
We're probably not going to, because everything here was gold.
Yeah, this was all gold.
maybe edit down the me rambling about the, you know, getting the start and stuff at first. I kind of ran.
I think your story's really interesting.
I think it's really
triad bit.
Well, okay, so I tell you what, you send me a text or a DM or something and let me know if there's anything in there that made you like uncomfortable or you want specific things to be taken out. Like, that's fine with me. I don't mind doing that. But I honestly really enjoyed the journey and better understanding what your origin story is, because there were pieces in there that I didn't know.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
There's that.
All right. So let's... I'm just going to clap us in. We're going to close the show. It'll take about 30 seconds. Okay.
Cool.
All right. All right. So that about wraps us up. If you are an indie developer or publisher and you have a game that you'd like to share with us for our recurring but not every episode indie spotlight, please do DM us at Virtual Econcast. David, the name of the show is Virtual Economy. The Twitter is at Virtual Econcast, VirtualEconcast. Not something something business, as good a name as that is.
Next time we'll get you to name our podcast.
Yes.
Sounds good.
Yep, and we have one more show this week.
We're going to
be speaking with Emily Rose from Rebind.io.
Hey, I just did an interview with Emily. She's great.
Oh, that's awesome.
We're really excited to talk to Emily about art house indies and the ways in which we can best support art house indies, especially during this time, but definitely going forward. So thank you so much for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. This has been episode 8. You can follow us on Twitter at @VirtualEconcast. I am at Amanda Farrow.
And I am at Footerish, F-U-T-T-E-R-I-S-H. Dave, where can people find you online?
Ooh, do I get to plug my stuff
you
now?
Get to you plug do. Your stuff, as much of it as you want.
I am at Dave Oshry on Twitter, D-A-V-E-O-S-H-R-Y. Don't buy our games because they're not on sale. Just go wishlist them, and I'm going to give them away for free because we hate .money. You can also find our games at notfortnite.com. I can't believe it's not hexen.com. PewDiePie.exposed.
Oh, my God. I love it.
If there's a dumb URL, I own the sumbitch. But yeah, you could find us there. New Blood is obviously at New Blood. Join our stupid Discord, 20,000 lurkers strong at discord.gg/newblood. Get out there, play games with your community, get engaged with the people that play your games because they are the most important people in your life, next to your wife and your kids and your dogs.
Awesome. You can subscribe to our RSS feed at virtualeconomy.libsyn.com/RSS. You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and find podcast delivery services near you.
It's very true. If you are able to, please review our show. Let us know how we're doing. If you have any requests, any questions, you can always add us at @VirtualEconcast and podcast@fsquared.biz. But most importantly, we want to tell those algorithms on all of those various platforms that we are, in fact, important and we matter. And the best way you can do that is to subscribe.
Smash that subscribe button.
This is really upsetting and I don't like it. All right. Well, we'll be back soon. In the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another. Thank you.